This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 3, String Contention Objections and Disputes, held on the 13th of February, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you were only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourself be known now? Hearing no one, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Karen Day. Please begin.
Thank you, Terry. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is Karen Day for the transcript. Thank you for joining us today for our meeting of Work Track 3 of Subsequent Procedures. Today, we will, if we could go ahead and flip the slides to our agenda, we'll take a look at what we're going to be doing today. Today, we will be doing our normal review of SOI updates. We'll get a brief update on the plenary from Jeff or Aubrey. Aubrey, we love you. We're glad you're here. Jeff or Cheryl, who graciously woke herself up in the middle of the Australian night for us today. Then we will move into our substantive issues for today, applicant freedom of expression, accountability mechanisms, and then time allowing string similarity. And then we'll close out by looking at our remaining upcoming meeting schedule between now and our face-to-face, which will be soon at ICANN 61. So if that agenda is agreeable to everyone, we will move on. If anyone wants to make any changes to the agenda, please do speak now. Not seeing any hands or comments at this point. I will move on and ask, does anyone have any updates to their SOI that they would like to let us know about at this time? Again, I'm not seeing any hands. I'm not seeing any indications in the chat. So we will then move on. And we had a meeting of the full working group yesterday. So I will call on Jeff today, since it is a more reasonable hour here in his time zone, and ask if he could give us a quick update on where the plenary is and what to look forward there. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Karen. This is Jeff Newman. Hopefully you all can hear me. As Karen said, we had a full working group plenary call yesterday, and we discussed the issue of whether to do rounds, first come, first serve, or some sort of hybrid of the two. I think it was a productive discussion. What we realized is that at this point for the preliminary, for the initial report, we're most likely going to do what we're doing in a lot of different areas, which is present the status of our discussions along with different options that we could choose going forward, but ones which we are going to seek public input on, citing the pros and the cons of each option. So very similar to a lot of the different topics that the work track leaders are working on with their issues. We are still on track for doing an initial report in April and having public comments come in after that. So that's just after the ICANN meeting. But I will also note that all of the work track chair leaders and the overall working group chairs are producing written documents to, along with ICANN policy, to reflect our discussions. And there'll be lots of links that you'll see in each of the meetings to these documents. Very important that you go to those documents and put comments directly in there if you have any, because these are the things that are going to show up in the initial report. So this is a critical time for all of us. And when Karen tells you to go to a link to see a certain document, then please do that and put your comments in. That's all I have for now. Thanks, Karen.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that. We will, with that, then move on into our first substantive topic for today, which is applicant freedom of expression. As you'll note in the chat, Emily has unlocked the slides so you can scroll for yourself. So if we'll go down to slide four, we're going to pick up with the discussion that we had on applicant freedom of expression, our last meeting, which Robin was leading. Just briefly, I will go over what we discussed there. Again, the principle, this is the string evaluation process must not infringe the applicant's freedom of expression rights that are protected under internationally recognized principles of law. Prior discussions in our work track earlier in the year were around implementation guidance should be included in the next applicant guidebook, informing applicants, panelists, and others of the existence of this recommendation and that the policy goal of fostering freedom of expression in generic top-level domains, and also how to balance protection of applicant free expression rights with government or other pressures to restrict the use of the words, use of certain words in top-level domains. After last week, what I have summarized here, these three bullet points, are the sort of high-level takeaways from last week's call. One, that there seemed to be general agreement that there was going to be no way to ensure a perfect implementation of this principle, of this concept, because it is of such a subjective nature. Number two, evidence of failure of policy implementation in the 2012 round is difficult to prove because it is the issues are complex, and they are oftentimes mixed in with other issues, such as community issues or geographic names issues. And by that, I mean that what one person will see as a failure of enforcement of this application of the principle here of applicant freedom of expression, for example, the .gay scenario that we discussed, another person will say that's not a freedom of expression issue, that's a problem with the community process. .amazon was another example that has been raised in the past as a freedom of expression failure. But others will say that's not got anything to do with freedom of expression, that's solely an issue of geographic names. So those are just two examples of how we have a lot of issues, complex issues intermingling, which are make this issue itself even more difficult to structure as a standalone with regards to implementation. And the third takeaway that we had from the leadership point of view from the last call is, as with accountability mechanisms, this topic is likely to be impacted by the final outcome of the cross-community working group on accountability, and we don't have that yet. So that is where we feel like we are, very high level. Wanted to offer up now, as we go into our writing phase, a chance for additional thoughts to speak to this topic. And then, as Jeff said, you will get from us a written product that we will ask you to then help us refine. With that said, Anne, please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Karen. I wanted to propose sort of a friendly amendment to the language that we're using here on the assumption that it's going to go into some kind of, report, a draft report that's going to be issued. On the second bullet point under prior discussions, where I believe that you described it in presenting the issue to us as a balancing. And here, I think the language about other pressure to restrict the use of words is a little bit partisan. I think that, free expression with government or other concerns regarding the use of words. I just don't think that pressure to restrict the use of words is a neutral, view of the concern in favor of free expression. We could say, with government or other concerns regarding terms, words of interest to various constituencies within ICANN. But I don't think it's quite fair to call it pressure to restrict the use of words. Thank you.
This is Karen, for the record. I guess, Anne, I'm trying to understand what I was trying to say is the pressure to restrict was in opposition to the freedom of expression. And so
in other words, it's what we're doing here is balancing interests.
Okay.
It's not that there are a bunch of people out there who want to, intentionally restrict free expression. It's really that the balancing of interests, and these are, presumably, if we follow, ICANN rules of, respecting other constituents, these are presumably, legitimate interests that are put forth on behalf of governments, on behalf of, the intellectual property constituency and others. And some of these also relate to consumer protection. And consumer protection is, that is really the trust and confidence in the Internet is really a part of ICANN's mission as well. And so I think we need to speak more neutrally about the balancing of these interests rather than describing all those other interests as the pressure to restrict the use of words. Because thank you.
Okay, thank you. No, I appreciate your explanation, and it is noted, and we will be sure to do that better crafting. I think I pulled that language from a transcript somewhere, and I just wanted to make sure I understood your point so I could, when we're writing it, could write it appropriately. But again, you'll be given ample opportunity to refine any writing that's done. Thank you again. Greg, please
go
ahead.
Thanks, Greg Shatton, for the record. First, I agree with Anne's concern about that language and probably was pulled from a transcript statement by someone who had a particular point of view. My question is actually something different. On the very last point at the bottom, as with accountability mechanisms, final outcome of CCWG accountability likely to impact this topic. I'm trying to think of what outcomes in that working group would impact this topic. Can somebody clarify what's being referred to here?
Greg, I will have to defer to staff or perhaps our senior leadership. This is Karen for the record again. I'm sorry. That was a note in the initial, either in our charter or in our initial working documents. There was a note in this section to be sure and allow room for input from accountability on this topic. So I was just carrying that forward, quite honestly, not well informed. Steve or Jeff, Cheryl, any of you know specifically what that note referenced? And I apologize for not being more informed. See, Steve is typing in the chat.
Karen, Jeff, can you just restate that, Karen? Sorry about that. The note, which note are we talking about here? The how to balance?
That there would be likely outcome of CCWG on accountability might impact this topic.
So obviously when the initial charter, or well, in the final report first was drafted and then the charter, that was before Workstream, that was even before Workstream 1 had finished its work or even had just gotten started. So to the extent we're talking about human rights, I think it was just one of those to make a note that if anything came out of Workstream 1 or Workstream 2 out of the human rights work, that we might need to reference that. But it was just for us to not forget about it. It wasn't anything specific that we were thinking about at the time that was drafted. It was just, hey, make sure you cross-reference this with the output, if any, from the accountability discussions.
Does that answer your question, Greg?
Well, this is Greg. First off, if that wasn't takeaway from the last call, it shouldn't be there as such. Secondly, it sounds like the current state of affairs is not so clear as this statement would make it appear to be. So I think this appears to be an overstatement. That we have both, and kind of a lack of clarity. If there's, you know, if there's a belief that the, you know, output of the human rights subgroup or the accountability group on as regards human rights has a specific effect here, we should be more clear. If that's what we're referring to, and that probably should be, you know, something to be studied. And of course, the CCWG doesn't make policy in any way in that regard. So it's really, in a sense, the outcome of whatever is put forth in front of the board and approved that then becomes the issue in it going forward. So I just think we need more clarity and kind of less of a sense that somehow there's this looming change that is likely to occur because of the accountability group as a whole. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Tijani, please.
Thank you very much, Karen. Tijani speaking. I would like to support what Ann said about considering the use of geo names or community names as a freedom of expression issue. It is more a competition of interests, and more specifically a competition between political interest and a business and financial interest. So please remove it from the freedom of expression part. Thank you.
Thank you, Tijani. I'll note, just read into the record, that Steve has put into the chat the language from the final issue report, which reads, "It should be noted that the Cross-Community Working Group on Enhancing ICANN Accountability seeks to integrate human rights impact analysis within its mission, which also should provide guidance to this PDP working group in its deliberations." So, add that in to the record there. Tijani, is that a new hand or is that your old hand?
It is an old hand.
Oh. Okay, thank you. Alan, please, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to interject that I personally don't really care, but there are people who consider this kind of discussion as a freedom of expression issue. You know, certainly the example of Amazon has been cited by people as this is a freedom of expression issue. So although some of us may not believe it should really be called freedom of expression, there are others who, perhaps not on this call, who feel strongly that that is indeed the right label for it. So we don't want to be making political statements in our titles, but recognize that, you know, there are different views on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. And I will note that Christine has made a similar comment in the chat, support for inclusion of geonames in the second bullet under takeaways for the last call. All right. Does anyone else have any other input to inform us on this applicant freedom of expression topic? Greg, please, go ahead. Greg, you may be on mute.
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes,
so,
go ahead.
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
So not to beat a dead horse, but on the last point, having been involved in both the accountability working group and the subgroup on human rights, one of the things that was clear in the overall result was that any use of human rights impact analyses as a mandatory policy, part of policy development, in GNSO would need to be something that was decided by the GNSO Council and can't be imposed by the CCWG, which doesn't have the power to change how PDP policy is made. So there is a there's a lot more nuance behind this, but it goes back to my initial point, which is that this is a an overstatement, an ambiguous overstatement of what might occur and what and how it might occur. So again, I think we need to change that. And if it wasn't what was talked about on the last call, then it shouldn't be under takeaway from last call. I apologize for not having been on the last call or read the transcript for it. So I do think that we need to, you know, if we are referring to freedom of expression here, and I guess I'm also concerned that the policy principles, I think, are, there's obviously a list of them, so this, you know, must intend to be balanced against others. And there's kind of a whole world of possible ways this could be implemented or not. So I'm not sure what implementation guidance you know, there would be, and whether implementation guidance should be in the guidebook, which itself is an implementation. So it seems like this is still very much a midstream sort of slide or a discussion here. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Anne, please, go ahead.
Yes, thanks, Ken. It's Anne for the record. I do understand the fine distinction that Greg is making with respect to the fact that the CCWG accountability does not make policy. But on the other hand, when it comes to, for example, the human rights work that we're kind of cross-referencing here, we do need to keep in mind that all the chartering organizations, you know, have the opportunity to have the opportunity in Workstream 1 and have the, you know, opportunity in Workstream 2 to adopt the work of the CCWG or not. And there's language in the bylaws about that human rights framework that's coming out of the CCWG work being forwarded by the chartering organizations to the board and the board adopting that. The reality of the structure of ICANN is, you know, recommendations go forward to the board and then the board either adopts them or doesn't adopt them. And the chartering organizations are involved here. So although I appreciate the fine distinction that Greg is making, I think that in particular in relation to this human rights area, what we're going to see is that it does impact our work, because of the framework. And, so I think the cross-referencing is perfectly appropriate. The second point that I wanted to make, about freedom of expression is I'm seeing a little bit of, I'm concerned that we want to talk about, you know, freedom of expression when it comes to, you know, issues of certain words being, you know, theoretically restricted, but I haven't sensed that we're, you know, concerned about freedom of expression in particular in community applications where some of the discussion in this group has been toward an idea that somebody within ICANN should be deciding whether a community application is a worthwhile application or not. And I'm personally very concerned that we put as much emphasis on freedom of expression in terms of not restricting the nature of community applications, because community is all about freedom of expression and exchange of ideas. And I think that we need to put as much emphasis on freedom of expression in, you know, the quote-unquote definition of community applications as we are doing in this section. Thank you.
Thank you, and I appreciate that input. Anyone else on applicant freedom of expression today? I see some typing going on in the chat. Greg, please come back.
Thanks, Greg Chapman, for the record, finally kind of located where these principles, recommendations, and implementation guidelines are in the 2007 report. And I see that, you know, among the recommendations, which, and what the balancing between the principles and the recommendations and implementation guidelines is exactly, is not clear to me, but among the recommendations are that strings must not be confusingly similar to an existing TLD or reserved names. Strings must not infringe the existing legal rights of others that are recognized or enforceable under generally accepted internationally recognized principles of law. Strings must not cause any technical instability. Strings must not be contrary to general accepted legal norms related to morality and public order, which cites the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and a bunch of other stuff as well. So it's clear that this principle can't be read in the abstract. And that even when freedom of expression rights are protected under internationally recognized principles of law, they are protected within a framework that also recognizes other rights, including other rights of expression, and this all a balancing act. So I think it's important to note that in any discussion of this policy principle. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. All right. As we are now at the half-hour mark, I am going to draw a line under this discussion for today. As Greg noted, we are still sort of in the midpoint of this, and I think as Jeff has explained and Cheryl have explained and others, where we're going with this in this initial report, the preliminary report that we're going to produce out of our work group, it's then going to go to the plenary. We're not looking to have consensus recommendations at this stage. It's going to go out. We're seeking more community input. It's then going to come back to the plenary group for more work. We are not done with this. So don't feel like we're rushing to conclusion here. But let's put some pen to paper and try and refine this, move forward from that viewpoint. I had some really good input today and appreciate that. Now, if we can go on and take a look at our next topic. This will be our first look at, for the third pass, as it were, at accountability mechanisms. And these include our processes such as the PIC-DRP, the PDDRP. And when we discussed these earlier in our work, We talked about things like, should the process make a distinction between accountability mechanisms and relating to substantive matters and accountability mechanisms relating to procedural matters? We discussed who should be the final arbiter of these matters. Should we have a panel of subject matter experts? Or, as one proposal was made, should the ICANN board be trained and empowered to be the final arbiter of these issues in this accountability mechanism going forward? We seem to somewhat have agreement, but we want to reconfirm that or even confirm that at all, that the panelists and the independent objector, and if we go the way we seem to be leaning in prior discussions on the independent objector, where we would have a pool of independent objectors, as it were, to choose from or to be selected from, that they should be subject to conflict of interest policies, and that those conflict of interest issues should be handled prior to the initiation of the substantive matters within the accountability mechanisms, so that any conflict of interest is dealt with before we get into the meat of what we're adjudicating. Then the next point that we've discussed is there a need for a post-decision appeal mechanism specific to this new GTLD process? There are numerous mechanisms that parties can and have used, but it's been suggested that perhaps we might need a post-decision appeal mechanism that is specific to this new GTLD application process. How do we feel about that? Is that something we feel we need to develop? So that's our sort of a summation of our, at a high level of our all of our prior discussions and our community input. And with that, I will want to turn it over to you to get your input and hear where you are on these matters and where we need to focus and head from here. Thank you. Jeff, please, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is a personal comment, not as a chair or anything like that. I absolutely feel like there's a need for a post-decision appeal mechanism specific to the new GTLD process. I know standards and the accountability mechanisms have been revised somewhat, and I'm not as familiar as many on this call or some on this call of the new standards, but the last time I read them, although they are better than what the previous bylaws said, which only looked to whether the board was acting in good faith, I still do not believe that the current accountability mechanisms allow for a complete substantive review of a decision. I know that there have been some improvements, but it still ultimately looks to whether the action violated the bylaws, and not necessarily whether it violated the guidebook itself or whether it goes against the process that was set up. So at this point, I know that the new bylaws aren't well tested, and I know that they've been revised, but at this point, from what I understand, it's still not the same as having a substantive review of a decision by ICANN staff or an evaluator. I'm happy to listen to others that may think that the bylaws does contain that, but even under the new bylaws, I don't believe that's covered. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Alan, please, go ahead.
Thank you. I strongly support that. It would be nice to think that as we rewrite all of our rules and try to ensure there is clarity and try to ensure that panels and others making decisions will do everything right, it's not going to happen. It would be nice to say we have panels of five people or three people for everything and not single people making judgment calls. But cost is going to factor in on that, and that may not happen also. I think we have to presume that there may well be judgments in error, judgments in implementing the rules incorrectly, essentially bad judgments, and there needs to be a way of addressing those and appealing them. So I strongly support the concept that we not rely on a process we write now to work several years later and just believe it has to have worked. There needs to be an appeal mechanism. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Jamie, please, go ahead.
Yes, Jamie Baxter for the record. I absolutely concur with Jeff's points as well, and I think that part of the reason we're seeing a need for the substantive review is because subject matter experts weren't used in the first place. I think if there's a rethinking of this, subject matter experts should be used from the beginning so that we can avoid a lot of the need for substantive reviews. But it's not to say that we shouldn't also have subject matter experts ready and available to review any appeals that may be necessary because of, as Alan says, bad judgments that come from some of the decisions. So I absolutely agree that this is something that needs a rethink from start to bottom.
Thanks, Jamie. Greg, please.
Thanks, Greg Chatman. I agree with Alan and Jeff and Jamie. I think the IRP, while much improved, is really a kind of constitutional remedy. And so you'd have to essentially make it sort of constitutional level challenge. That's something this is, you know, it was never intended to act as a kind of all-weather appeals process or mechanism. There was some discussion in the IRP group as we were working on it that perhaps it could be additional purposes could be added to the same panel, but that was, you know, just kind of idle chatter, I would say, or, you know, nothing with the force of decision. I'm all in favor of a post-decision appeal process. I think that, you know, we learned the hard way that, you know, creating kind of a an adjudication system from scratch that's only one level is fraught with danger. I think the United States learned that, you know, a few hundred years ago. We started out with one level of trial courts, and now there's, you know, several levels. And I'm sure that European and Asian and countries elsewhere learned it hundreds of years before that, that you can't just rely on one level of decision-making and then just kind of an appeal to the king after that. So I think that, you know, it really needs to be built in, and this needs to be considered, you know, as a kind of quasi-jurisprudential review, even if it's, you know, not a legal review per se. And, you know, the issues arose that there were, you know, inconsistent decisions, that kind of a decision-making decision-making grew, and so you had some early outliers from it. You know, nothing atypical of growing pains except for the fact that there was no way to clean it up. So I think we should not make that mistake twice. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. In reading the chat here, I know that Rubens has submitted two ideas, and I would like, if he is available to speak to them, to ask him a question. Rubens' ideas that he put in the chat: idea number one, no panels of less than three members. Idea number two, substantive review is only available if a dissenting opinion existed in the original decision. Rubens, my question for you is, are these ideas for the original panels that would be a part of the new GTLD process, such as community priority evaluation, objection panels? Are you suggesting that all of those panels would have no less than three members, and then a substantive review would only happen if there was a dissenting opinion in those cases? Or are your ideas that in this new post-decision appeal mechanism that we're talking about making, we would have a panel of three, and then that could only go for a second appeal if there was a dissent? I see Rubens is not in a position to speak today, so hopefully he can answer that. The first, okay, starting panels would need to be three or more. Then this new appeals mechanism would come in if there was a dissenting opinion in that mechanism. Okay, so I'm going to let Jamie speak. He has his hand raised, but I'll ask for people to come in after Jamie's spoken and speak to that suggestion from Rubens. Jamie, please go ahead.
Jamie Baxter. I think one of the immediate struggles I see with Rubens' idea for community applications is everything was a secret. So we don't actually know anything about the panelists. We don't know anything about their personal opinions. So it would also require a serious revamp of the way community applications are evaluated, because there were two panelists, and again, it was a complete secret. So it would need to, you know, be rethought as to how community evaluations take place. Thanks.
Thank you, Jamie. Anyone else on want to speak to that idea of Rubens. I know we have discussed having panels. Some have suggested that we let the parties decide if they want to have a single panel or a multiple person panel, and if they're willing to pay the increased fees to support a three-person panel as opposed to a single one. Cheryl, please go ahead.
Thanks, Cheryl, for the record. I think here at this part of the discussion where we're looking at the nature of such a panel, and it does objecting to the existence of them, that there might be some use in looking at the changes in standards and recommendations that have come out for the new IRP, in as much as it is a more standing design with a pool of known entities with criteria requirements, and so it's a much more transparent set of circumstances. So whilst earlier on in the chat the references were suggesting that there is no influence with the revamped new IRP, there may be some useful benchmarking on standards for panels that can be taken from that. Just a thought. Thanks.
Thank you, Cheryl. Anyone else to speak to this idea of Rubens or to any other of these issues at this time? Do we have agreement? Let's move back up a bullet point here on our slide, and I'll rephrase this. Is there anyone on the call today who would object to the idea of establishing some sort of guideline going forward that any panelist, independent objector, should be subject to conflict of interest policies, and that those would be handled transparently prior to the initiation of substantive matters in any type of adjudication and accountability mechanism within the new GTLD process? Anyone opposed to that idea? In other words, keeping the status quo, which did not include that. Cheryl, I'm going to take a wild guess and assume that that check mark means that you're in favor of it, not that you're opposed to it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Cheryl wants to go back into the closet and have everything done in secret. All right. Okay. Good. So
that's a hell no, of course. And it's definitely a joke for the record.
Yes.
Transparency.
Yes. All right. Let's we got that one covered. Let's move back up one more bullet point. And let's talk about the final arbiter. Who should be the final arbiter of these matters? Should we establish subject matter experts for each of these various subject matters that we deal with in these accountability mechanisms? Should it be the ICANN board? Should they be trained and empowered to absolutely be the decision maker? How do people feel about that? Jamie, please go ahead.
Yes, Jamie Baxter for the record. I think instead of, for me, it's not about deciding should it be subject matter experts or the ICANN board per se, but I think it should be people who can actually address the problems at hand. And in some cases, that may be subject matter or that may be empowered ICANN board members who feel like they actually can take a stand against things that have been egregiously directed. So I think that avoiding the problems is really the problem. And when evidence shows that something has went wrong and everybody cries that it's not in their wheelhouse, sorry, we can't deal with it, that is the real problem. So I'm not sure what the right answer is as to who should be the final arbiter, but I think whoever it is should be empowered to be able to look at the full picture and address the issues that are being brought forward.
Thank you, Jamie. Anyone else? Robin types in the chat, when the ICANN board believes its fiduciary duty is at issue in the case, they must have the last say. But on issues that don't invoke that duty, it could be other decision makers. Let me ask this question of the group, and I do not propose that I know the answer. Would it be fair to have different final arbiters in different matters, or do we need to have a consistent final arbiter across all matters? Does it have to be the same, always the board, or always, or never the board, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Does it need, for consistency's sake, does it always need to be the same body that is the final arbiter? anyone want to speak to that? Because when we have opinions such as, you know, it just needs to be somebody that can make a decision, that leaves it open to going between different groups, I think. Christina notes in the chat that it's challenging to make a decision about an appeal mechanism without getting into the details. that is true. We are not at that stage yet. Avery notes in the chat, at the end of the days, most days isn't the IRP board EC courts. Jamie, please, go ahead.
Yes, Jamie Baxter for the record. I think another point to include here is whatever this turns into, it needs to also address the issue of the board just continually kicking the can down the road because it's unable or unwilling to make decisions about certain things. I think for the benefit of applicants, there needs to be a system that shortens the accountability mechanism process. Because right now we're seeing it, you know, expand into multiple years because people just aren't able or aren't willing to make decisions based on the facts that are presented because, as I said earlier, they say it's not in their wheelhouse or it's not something that they can actually address. And so we need to find a system that shortens all of this so that it can be dealt with quickly and efficiently and at much less cost than it's incurring for those involved, both from the applicant side and also from the ICANN side. So something else to consider, I think.
Thank you, Jamie. Steve, go ahead.
Thanks, Karen. This is Steve from staff. And in reference to this question that you asked about the final arbiter, I was just trying to clarify if this is possibly in reference to the accountability mechanisms under the bylaws, or if it's in reference to evaluations, or if it's perhaps in reference to the post-decision appeal mechanisms referenced as the last bullet, or if maybe it's some or all of those things. If it's in relation to the post-appeal mechanisms, maybe it ties into the comment from Christina Rosetta about the details of a possible appeal mechanism. You know, so the last bullet references that this might be a possibility, but there's probably quite a bit of details that might be needed, including all the things that she mentioned, also maybe who pays for it, who, as the second bullet might reference to, who maybe makes final decisions in those cases and other matters. So I was just looking for clarity for myself and perhaps for the other work check members. Final arbiter, what is it in reference to specifically? Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Yes, in going back through all of the notes, chats, and transcripts over the last 18 months or so, this covered everything. And it seemed to be, it all sort of funnels into the need for a post-decision appeal mechanism for this process who is going to be the final arbiter on matters of new GTLD applications and issues. So perhaps my bulleting should have been a little bit better here. I should have perhaps dropped that down to the bottom and indented it under that post-appeal application mechanisms. The topic came up in just about every type of decision-making process we discussed. But if you boil it all down and you realize that people generally seem to be looking for some common approach to dealing with issues within this new GTLD process, and another commonality that they seem to be looking for is a common arbiter of these decisions. I hope that helps make it maybe a little bit less muddy, more like weak tea. But that was sort of the genesis. I see now that we've got 1 minute left, so I'm going to very quickly ask one question and sort of try and take another temperature of the room thing that I think we might have some agreement on, and then give you some homework. Temperature of the room, sort of hand-raising poll, checkmark poll here. Do we pretty much agree that we need to make a distinction in accountability mechanisms relating to substantive issues and procedural issues? Check marks if you agree that it needs to be split. X marks or no's in the chat if you think that it can just all flow through the same process.
It's Alan. Could I get in for a moment?
Yep, sure.
I really think the question is, it's clear that on substantive issues you're going to need subject matter experts. It is not clear on procedural issues you need subject matter experts on the original subject. And for that reason, I could say it could be split, or it could be one process, but with different rules for how one selects who the arbitrators are. So I'm not sure how to answer it because of that.
All right. Thanks. Okay. Got it. Jeff, is your suggestion for a Visio diagram for this question?
I think my suggestion is for just to figure out, I guess, where what Steve was saying about where appeals would come in. And I'm just trying to think of all the different scenarios, either where an application process ends, either because it failed the evaluation, or where it was forced into contention because it didn't get, like, community priority. Just I think what you do is map out, essentially, where appeals could fall in.
Okay.
And then that might help us. That might help us decide, well, once we know the different types of appeals, that might help us think about the process and whether we need to distinguish between substantive and procedural.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you. All right. We are 2 minutes over, and I am going to let you go because I'm actually late for another call myself. Homework, please, if you would indulge us. Take the slides that I emailed out prior to the meeting, which is this deck here, read through string similarity, and which then loops naturally back into string confusion objection issues. Read through those, and please send thoughts around on the list. We're going to be getting some docs up, Google Docs, and we'll be sending you some links. Let's try and get some work done on this topic and continue our discussions on the other two topics on the list in the interim 2 weeks. The last slide in the deck is our meeting schedule from now until we see each other in March in San Juan, where hopefully it will be sunny and warm. And with that, I thank you all for joining us, and have a great day. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks, everyone. Bye for now.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.